It's after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. And with me now is Bill Lee, who pitched for the Boston Red Sox from 1969 to 79. And in the period of 1973 to 75, he won 51 games. But Lee, who was nicknamed the Spaceman, was as famous for his antics as for his pitching. And once in the middle of a close game, he called the catcher, coach, and third baseman to the mound to inform them that his lips were chapped. Another time he showed up on the mound wearing a beanie with a propeller on it. He also gave witty and sarcastic quotes to the press, sometimes ridiculing the manager of the Red Sox or managers of rival teams. Lee was traded to the Montreal Expos in 1979. He was let go from the Expos in 82. He now plays semi-pro ball in Canada and pro ball in Latin America. He does commentary and book reviews for the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company. He's written a new memoir. It's titled The Wrong Stuff, and it's published by Viking. Billy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When you were first drafted by the Red Sox, did you think you'd actually, you know, make it to the Major League?
No, I wanted to be a forest ranger, and my parents and my grandparents, they all controlled the University of Southern California, so I ended up getting a scholarship there to play ball and to learn. But I always had it back in my heart that I wanted to be a forest ranger, and I kept winning and I kept being good, and I loved to play baseball. It gets into your system, and you know, you like that confrontation, batter pitcher confrontation, and I got better and better, and finally I played minor league ball for 3 months, and I got called up the Red Sox. They told me not to unpack my bags because I won't be there that long, and I stayed there for 9 years and 102 days.
How did they test you out when you got there to see how good you were and how you acted under pressure?
They don't give you a saliva test or anything like that. They run you out there right away. Dick Williams was the manager, who was a great manager, and he does that with kids. When he gets them, he throws them out there. He doesn't let them sit around and get nervous. He gets them out there while they're still fresh and right from the minors, and to find out how they can do. And he lets them throw 3 or 4 times, and then see what he can use them for in situations. And he did that to me, and because of the way he handled me, I got to stay around for a long time.
Can you do that under pressure when you're trying to prove yourself? No one really knows who you are. You don't have a reputation yet because you're brand new.
It's scary. It's like anything in life when you sink or swim, Billy Pilgrim. They throw you in the pool, you know, and hopefully you swim, you know. Sometimes you don't and you go to the bottom. And some guys do well, and then all of a sudden something changes in their life. There was a guy named Blass, a pitcher, who was a champion of the World Series. And the next year he couldn't throw the ball over the plate to save his life, and they don't know what happened. Maybe it was the notoriety that caused his problems, but there are psychological problems, and usually that's what happens to pitchers.
Do you ever have a dream something like that would happen to you? One day you'd wake up and you wouldn't be able to pitch anymore?
I have dreams, nightmares, but once I wake up, I see I'm awake, and that's fine with me.
When you first started pitching in Fenway Park, how did you figure out what was required in that park to...
I learned that in college. Uh-huh. I learned that from just Euclid and Descartes and angles and, physics and stuff. The park is very short and left, and it's very big and right. So the plate where it is, you know, velocity and momentum, I just pitched everybody away, and we played them away and let them hit them to the deep part of the park. And then people that tried to pull me hit the ball on the ground, and I had good infielders, and they made the plays. It's knowledge. I was a pitcher. A lot of guys are throwers, and management likes throwers, but I knew how to pitch. And I pitched with my head, and I don't think people like me for that.
Now, who's doing the strategy? Because the catcher's giving you
the
cues,
signs.
Right? He's giving you the signs. But have you discussed all that beforehand?
Yes, usually. It happens in meetings. They always discuss how to pitch people, and then whatever they say, I do the opposite because I'm left-handed. And usually the meeting's conducted by a right-hander, and his ball is moving in the exact opposite. You know, he's moving against the Coriolis effect, the spin of the earth, and I'm going with it. And I know I learned how to pitch, and I pitched my ball game. And Fisk, after a while, he settled down and realized that I like to pitch people away. And we just buried the ball away on right-handed hitters until they started hitting the ball the other way. And once they adapt and change their stroke, then I have them. Because now they're trying to hit my pitch, you know, and they're not waiting for their pitch. It's just a battle. It's a struggle, kind of a confrontation of, you know, a movable object meets irresistible force. And once he adapts to my style, then I can go back in, inside part of the plate, you know, and saw him off, as they say, and force him to go get another piece of northern ash.
Do you think being left-handed has been an asset for you?
Oh, most definitely. I think so, because I could throw strikes, and, you know, I just had a God-given talent, you know, and I think I took advantage of it really good. But things were in my head. I was too bright, as they say, for baseball, and it caused me my job, you know, for a few ball clubs, because I stuck up for my fellow ball players, and I just wanted to be treated as an equal, and there's no way baseball will treat you as an equal. They'll pay you a lot, but you will never be an equal.
How'd you get the name The Spaceman?
I probably just speaking out, but I got it specifically because I pitched a great game in Baltimore and I didn't want to talk about my accomplishments. I wanted to talk about the moon program because a guy had smuggled a 2-iron up to the moon and I wanted to know how far he hit the ball. And they say, this guy's really a space cadet. And it kind of, everybody started calling me that. And, you know, I thought that was their problem. It wasn't mine because, you know, I don't answer to that name. And every time I sign my name, like I've autographed lots of books lately, and I've been signing my name Earth 84, whatever the date is.
You were known for a lot of crazy antics on the field. Can you only pull that off if you're really good and you know you are and everybody else knows you are too?
I don't know. I never thought they were crazy. They made me wear the beanie.
Who made you wear it?
Sports Illustrated. They made me put the space
really?
Suit on. You know, I don't do things initially on my own.
Uh-huh.
A man came to me and gave me a gas mask, and I played third base and infield because he believed that the air was polluted, and he asked me if I'd do him a favor. Other people criticize us, saying that we don't deserve to be on the field with the same ball club with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So I dressed as grubbly as I could, you know, and I had my clothes inside out, and I played warmed up like that. Just looked even worse, you know, and they call those antics. I call them, you know, I protested, you know, people that are solidified in their beliefs, you know, and the only way to awaken them is to slap them across the side of the head and gain their attention.
Well, a lot of ballplayers, when they're talking to the press, will just say things like, you know, we've got a great team, it's a great club, we're going to win that game. And you'd say things like, Steinbrenner's like a Nazi, you know. Didn't it bother you or scare you that you were going to jeopardize your future by being that sarcastic and outspoken in public?
I never thought of it. I thought the United States guaranteed you the right of freedom of speech. And I've always, you know, held them up like that. I was fined $250 by Bowie Kuhn, and the ACLU came to my defense. And we sued Bowie Kuhn, and he didn't show up at the court appearance, and he was held in contempt of court. So I think I did a good job there, you know, forced the owners to hand back my money, but I didn't ask for it. I gave my money freely away because I gave it to a mission in St. Mary's, Alaska, a friend of mine, a father up there who runs this mission, and I wasn't going to tell him, you know. I figured Bowie had matched my offer or something.
What are some of the quotes that caused a lot of controversy centered around you that you gave to the press?
Well, the biggest one in Boston was the fact that I said Judge Arthur Garrity, who had to enforce the busing, I said he was the only man in Boston with any guts, you know, and the Irish community came down on me and wanted my head right away, said that, you know, that it was wrong and stuff, that you're a ball player, you should only play baseball and stuff. But I had made that statement because the press had come in after we had lost to Cleveland in a very big one-sided game early in the season, and Yastrzemski had, in an anger, thrown his bat up against the roof of the dugout, and his finger happened to be attached to it, and he almost broke it. So I was trying to take the heat off of everything, and by doing that, you know, the press jumped on me, and they kind of left us alone, and we went on to win. And I'm that way. You know, I'm like a governor, and I take the heat for everyone else.
My guest is Bill Lee, if you're just joining us, and he's written a new memoir called The Wrong Stuff. How do you know when you're pushing too far, though, in the relations that you have either with the press or in what you say to the manager of the team that you're on?
Well, I don't find out about it until later. I mean, I was kicked out of the Expos because unfairly, you know, because I wasn't throwing that poorly. In fact, I was throwing pretty good. And I was sticking up for guys. It happens all of a sudden. People can only stand so much. And then once you touch a nerve and you hit them right where it hurts, you know, then they get rid of you. And I'm finding that out, you know, on this tour, because I get canceled here and there because management's very powerful. You know, this planet's run by the GMs of baseball. You know, that's their little game. And I was rocking the boat because I wanted to be treated as an equal.
Several sports writers have commented that people who became very friendly with you on the team in the Red Sox were traded, and that they couldn't really get rid of you, but they'd get rid of people who got close to you. Do you think that that's the way it was?
Well, I know for a fact, you know, I was a lonely person there for a while, you know, when they started going all at once. But that's, you know, they were cutting off their nose despite their face, you know. They were hurting the whole ball club and hurting themselves by trying to punish me. I remember one time I was late for a plane. Actually, I wasn't late for a plane. I was early for it. And the ball club took a team bus, and I went out to the airport early with Bernie Carbo. And I remember that they were excited because I wasn't on it. So they got the bus on the plane right away and pulled out of the dock, thinking they left Carbo and I behind to punish us. As it turned out, they also left Lynn, Burleson, and our starting pitcher Eckersley behind too. So, you know, there they were trying to punish me, and they actually, you know, had to force almost an emergency decision to get a new pitcher.
What do you think that the Red Sox would have wanted to get rid of you?
Why?
Yeah.
Did they want to get rid of me?
Well, if you accept the theory that you were too valuable to let go, but so instead they let other people go who became close to you. Well, I mean, why? What reasons do you think lay behind that?
I don't know. I just think I associated with maybe marginal ball players that, you know, didn't have that much ability. Willoughby had a great year once year, but he was let go. Wise, Ferguson, Jenkins, they were good, but they were injured. It's just coincidence, you know, more than anything else. That's not the big problem here. The mm-hmm. big problem was they got rid of me because I was a 9-year, 102-day man. And when you're a 10-year man with 5 years with the same club, they can't get rid of you. They have to keep you forever. And I got within 40 days of that, and boom, I was gone. You know, so no way they wanted me to be a 10-year man, because then I would have been mayor of Boston or something.
You've complained that baseball has become too corporate. What are some examples of that?
Well, the biggest thing, I don't know if I use the word corporate. What I said was they're getting too specialized. They're getting too AstroTurf, designated hitter. You know, the parks are all getting to look the same. Everybody's got a mascot. It's taken away from the aesthetics of the game, the true playing in the dirt, the fans real close to you, the crack of the bat. You know, you're so removed in certain places, you don't even see a ball game, and it's just a hype. It's a big sell. And I like baseball in small parks, you know, Wrigley Field, Fenway Park. You know, I don't like the vet here. I don't like AstroTurf. I don't like anything about it. It's a stadium, and stadiums where you feed the Christians to the lions. And I'm against all that, and they call me the liberal and the radical, when actually their views are radical. I am an ultra-conservative. You know, I do not believe in tampering with the planet Earth, and they are tampering with the belly button of Earth, which is baseball. It's a great game that was created, you know, and they're tampering. And now TV is getting so big that, you know, everybody's got an agent, and they're all selling other things. And every ball player goes out there, you don't think of him as, you know, a great ball player. You recognize him as someone for some other product, and that's detrimental to the youth of America. And baseball promotes that, and that's what I think is detrimental.
Would you ever do a testimonial?
Testimonial?
For you know, a commercial testimonial on behalf of a product or a bank?
Oh, I had to do one in New Brunswick this year, but that was to get our ball club the financial base to even start, but it wasn't for me. And that's the only time I ever did it, and I had to look into that one-eyed monster, and I couldn't stand it, so I joked around a little, and they were great. But it was, people know I don't use the product or anything. It was just, you know, a catch-on up there to get money for the organization. And I have never sold, and I will never sell. I don't believe in selling. I'm a consumer.
You've criticized the Yankees for being the most conservative team, and for being the team heading in the direction that you most disapprove of in baseball, what bothers you about the Yankees?
Well, they've always bothered me. You know, the Yankees have gotten, they have stole from the Red Sox. First of all, they stole Babe Ruth, and then they stole Cy Young and Sparky Lyle, and all we got was Danny Cater and No-No Nanette. You didn't know that, did you? They sold No-No Nanette was what they traded the play for Babe Ruth. He financed the play with it, and it's absurd that the greatest ball player of all time was in Boston. Boston has been just taking over the Coles constantly, and I've felt very bad. I'm a Bostonian. I would never play for the Yankees.
You were almost traded to the Yankees?
I almost was in 71, and I'm thankful that I didn't go, you know. At that time, they didn't bother me too much. You know, I didn't think that much. But as I watched it, as I grew up in the American League and saw it, I saw the things they did, and I just couldn't handle it. It's such a violent place, you know, and maybe I played well there because it was violent. But I don't like them. They're armed guards. They frisky going in to watch the ball game, and it's not my idea. Maybe it's for the security of the player, and it's necessary and the Bronx, but I disagree. I believe, you know, I'm a nurture versus nature. You know, I believe everybody is born good, and we only create them bad. You know, so I've bared my vulnerable underside to the Yankee fans, and once you do that, they don't want you. If you're hostile towards them, they love that.
You almost got killed in Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, I did. I almost got killed. Gotten killed a lot of places in ballparks. You know, and.
You want to describe how that fight broke out in Yankee Stadium?
Yeah, I made a mistake. I threw a fastball, got it up out over the plate, and the guy hit it to right field for a base hit. And Evans came up with a throw to the plate, a great throw, and we got Pinella, the tying run at the plate. So that was the third out of the inning. But it was such an emotional part of the game that they spilled out onto the field real fast. And I had to save Carlton Fisk, so I started pulling guys off of Fisk. And I ended up getting sucker punched in the back of the head and then dumped on my shoulder and tromped on. And I ended up dislocating my elbow. And the doctor for the Yankees, who examined me first, said I'd never pitch again. And I said, "You're nuts." And I pitched a year later.
Yeah, I want to talk later about the kind of therapy that you used to get back in shape. But what were the fans like? I mean, here you were just getting everything kicked out of you. And what was the fans' reaction?
They came
on
to kill me, too. Mm-hmm. I had to pin one of them against the dugout with my spikes up against his throat, you know, till the police came and took him away. But fans were spilling out on the field, wanted to get me, too. And I was already dead and injured, you know. It's amazing. But I was 12-5 against the Yankees. I was a Yankee killer. And Billy Martin knew that, and they went after me.
What does it do to your view of human nature when you know, baseball fans are coming out trying to beat you up to join in with the other team?
Well, that's human nature. I think it's the fact that we eat too much meat, and we've got to become more like Zingiathropus man instead of Australopithecus, you know, with our eye teeth. We've got to, if every man stood up and ripped his eye teeth out at this time, nuclear war would stop because we wouldn't be able to eat meat, and we'd start becoming very pacific. And I have all these theories that I think would work. But they're very painful theories.
You a vegetarian?
I'm trying to be. I'm almost there.
You still enjoy meat, but you just think it's bad for you.
Yeah, I know it's bad for me. I know how I feel after a meal like that, you know. But that aggressiveness, people like that. I mean, it's a dual-edged sword. You can't have one without the other type of thing.
My guest is pitcher Bill Lee, and he's written a memoir. It's titled The Wrong Stuff. Did you have any pitcher superstitions, you know, rituals that you have to go through before a game?
None.
Like that?
None. I didn't believe in that. A lot of pitchers wouldn't cross double lines, and they wouldn't do this, and they had to have everything perfect laid out for them and stuff. I just got to the park. I never planned in advance in my whole life. I still don't plan in advance. I mean, I'm getting better now, like I planned for a cab to go to the airport after this show. But that's something I never would have done before. And usually when you plan, nothing occurs perfectly. But if you don't plan, everything has a kind of its own tempo that unfolds. And each game is different. It's like a flower opening up. And that's the way I approached it. And sometimes I'd take a nap up till 5 minutes before game time. Other times I would run 6 miles to the ballpark. It all depended on that day, on how things unfolded. And I don't wear a watch, and I don't believe in time, really. I'm anti-time.
Would you ever do anything on the mound to visually intimidate the batter?
Oh, I did. I didn't do it to intimidate. I just did it because it was funny. Like when No Neck Williams came up to the plate, he was a short little black guy that used to waddle his feet back and forth and hunch his shoulders up like this, and they called him No Neck. So I'd do the same thing on the mound and hunch my shoulders up, and he'd step out, and then I'd step off the mound, and he'd yell and scream at me, and then I'd get back on the mound and do the same thing, and he didn't like it. And I, you know, when Hargrove was a hitter, he used to take too long getting into the batter's box. He had all these rituals and mannerisms, and if a pitcher does that, he gets charged with a ball. But if a hitter does that, he doesn't get charged with a strike. He can take all the time he wants. So I was protesting that, and that caused that. In fact, that episode caused Billy Martin to get fired for the first time from Texas. And I can see why Billy Martin doesn't like me, because I get under his skin.
Will batters ever do anything to intentionally intimidate the pitcher and try to throw the pitcher off?
They'll step out of the box. And I remember one guy who was a born-again Christian guy. What was his name? Played for the Minnesota Twins, Jerry Terrell. And right when Diego Segui was ready to pitch, he says he got a flash from God, and he reached down onto the plate to grab a handful of dirt, and Diego Segui stopped his windup because he's a nice guy. And the umpire called a balk, and the winning run scored from third, and Terrell thought that was genius. I thought that was the worst thing I'd ever saw in baseball, you know, and you know, I just wanted to drill him after that for about 5 years. And he's a nice guy, but if you can't hit the ball, you know, don't go to cheating to score runs, you know. People say that's great thinking. I don't consider that great thinking. That's cowardice under battle. And I see there's lots of little gimmicks that people use. Usually what's the best gimmick, though, is to hit a home run after the guys. I've seen guys do that. The pitcher will throw at their head trying to scare them, and the batter will just get up there. He'll be all concentration. You can see Zen in the art of hitting at its highest level. Everything is slowed down. No matter what the pitcher throws the next pitch, the hitter has ultimate concentration because you woke him up. You alerted his senses by throwing into a zone that you shouldn't have thrown into. And great hitters capitalize on that. So if a guy was a great hitter, I made sure I didn't wake him up. I believed in the theory of letting sleeping dogs lie. You know, and I pitched them away. Let them have their singles, their doubles, but I kept away from the long ball.
Will you look a batter in the eye? I know it's far away, but will you still try to kind of make that eye contact before a pitch?
No, I never did that. I did not want that because the plate was my territory. I would look at him. I would look him over real good to see where he was standing, see what kind of stance, what size bat he was using, everything else. You know, I'd examine that, but I tried to make it as though as impersonal a situation as not.
Would you watch a lot of baseball games on TV so that you could see batters, as you know, in as many situations up against as many pitchers as you could to help you figure out what kind of batter they were and what you could do with them?
Only if a guy was Tommy John or Zahn or some of the pitchers that threw just like me, then I would watch it. Anybody else, I wouldn't watch it at all because it didn't mean a thing. All it would be confusing data. So I wouldn't. And plus, I didn't like watching baseball on TV. It lost a lot. You know, when I go into Fenway Park right now, you know, you take your beer and you dip your fingers in your beer and you cross yourself. You know, it's just like going into church. And I think all fans ought to do that more often. And that way you wouldn't be looking at the mascot and you won't be looking at this and that. You know, and the spirit of Shoeless Joe will come on the field, you know, and you'll be in harmony with nature and the game will go on forever. It'll be a great game, you know, and that's heaven.
So if you found out too much about a batter, it would be confusing data?
I think so. If you tried to input what Nolan Ryan throws against somebody and you're not Nolan Ryan, you know, you've got to more or less find out what you've got and find out someone else throws almost just like you and use his data.
There's still a lot of spitballs thrown.
I think so. I think guys that have sore arms and are hurting or having trouble getting people out will resort to anything. Gaylord Perry made millions and millions of dollars of that. You know, he used KY gel. He'd line the top of his hat, and it was water-soluble, so it would just bead up and drop down his forehead. And he'd reach up and get it and go through his mannerisms and put his fingers on the ball, and he'd throw this hellacious spitter that he'd come up there, and the bottom would fall out of it. And the hitters would complain, and the umpires would laugh, and, you know, everybody was yuck-yuck. Gaylord was a fierce competitor, but he cheated, too.
Are there other ways of cheating that are used fairly commonly?
There were a lot of different ways. Don Sutton used to rough up the ball with sandpaper to create a rough side, which would aerodynamically change the ball, which would cause it a low pressure on one side to break the other way. You know, and Mike Marshall, one of the great physical or knowledgeable men in baseball on, you know, the physics and physiology of exercise, how muscles worked, you know, and could impart certain spin on the ball. He used sandpaper, too. Here he spends millions of dollars on his PhD and stuff, and he uses a 15-cent piece of sandpaper to get the job done.
Who gets angry about that, batters or pitchers?
Oh, batters.
Because, I mean,
in opposing pitchers, if you're throwing against the guy.
Uh-huh.
But I knew how to use it, so every time he'd leave the mound, his ball would be out there, and I could use his ball for like three batters and get him out because I knew which way it was going, too.
Would you have to pitch differently if you've used something like that, if you've sanded down part of the ball?
Well, you would have to know which side of the rough side to put up.
Uh-huh.
You know, up meaning facing the hitter. It breaks. If you put the sandpapered side towards the hitter, it breaks away from him. If you turn it around the other way, the ball breaks in on the hitter. So you got to know which way your ball is going or you'll get in trouble.
What's the code among pitchers about whether, you know, you'd say something or not if you know a pitcher's doing that?
Well, it's up to the umpire. That's his job, you know, and he should know it. But most umpires don't have degrees in physics and don't really understand what's happening. They're supposed to call what they see, you know, not what they think they see. So that's why people get away with it. Plus, it happens very fast.
But a pitcher would never say anything about another pitcher?
No, yeah, they'd say about it all the time. People accuse Sutton all the time of doing it, but you could never catch him. He was Harry Houdini out there. Just like Gaylord Perry was Harry Houdini. It was the mimic, the doing 50,000 things, and which one was illegal, you know.
How many games can you pitch in a row without feeling like you're jeopardizing your arm?
In relief, you can throw up to three innings every day for like about 4 days, and then you've got to take a rest because you build up too much lactic acid in your muscles, and you've got to get that out. And the only way to get that out is with exercise and rest. Other than pitching, you know, some guys had the ability, they're better physical specimens and they could handle it more. But the rule is you can only start every ball game every fourth day. And in the old days, you used to do that. Now it's every fifth day because they have five-man rotations, more or less trying to protect their product. And it all depends on the individual and what kind of shape he's in. But it's like I said, a muscle that contracts all the time, produces lactic acid, and you just have to, nature's got to take its course.
When you're up on the mound and there's a really good batter up and the ball's hit, do you ever flinch and get the feeling that the ball's going to hit you? I mean, does something like that ever happen?
Oh, yeah, you get hit lots of times. And I got hit like 9 times in 1 year severely, you know, but that's occupational hazard, you know, and it doesn't hurt that much. Pain is, you once you pitch a lot, pitching is painful. So the other pain that comes along with it, losing teeth or this or that, that's insignificant. You get to be a zen out there. You get to be a yogi where you can almost cut off pain to certain areas of your body and proceed on with the game. And people call that intestinal fortitude. That's not intestinal fortitude. It's just you're so conditioned to it now. I remember getting hit twice in the same spot in 2 consecutive starts, and that was just too much for me to bear. I just sat down and cried for about 2 minutes, you know, just thinking, this is ridiculous, because I thought for sure it broke my leg, but x-rays showed it wasn't broken. It just hit on the same hematoma that I had before, and that just, you know, it was like dropping 2 atom bombs on top of each other. It seemed like overkill. But it's... injury's part of the game. You just survive it. But the thing about it is, when you're pitching really good and they're hitting line drives back at you, you see everything slower, you know, so you can catch them balls or you can get out of the way of them. I remember ducking balls that would have, people go, how did you get your body out of the way of that pitch, you know? And I'm saying, I didn't think it was hit that hard. And people go, you didn't think it was hit that hard. It hit off the center field wall, you know, and you're 60 feet 6 inches from it, and you got out of the way. It's a dance, and I believe I learned through the Cleveland Library when I started reading about this that it's a mystical thing, and it's Eastern religion that pitchers practice. It's like Carlton. He's definitely a devotee of a guy I know, George Ivanovich Gurdjieff, who believes in the dance. The dance, you're constantly dancing, and you're stretching your muscles, and your mind gets in tuned, and then you can see everything passing you, you know, very slowly, where everyone else can't see it, but you're seeing things that no one else has seen. And I love that state, and that's why I keep playing. But management's taken that away from me at the professional level. But even in New Brunswick, I'm throwing better than I ever have before. People are criticizing me now because I'm hitting too many home runs against these kids and playing too well, you know. And that's, you know, I don't complain, you know, because they want me to play as good as I can. And I'm not going to, you know, pull punches just because, you know, I'm not allowed to play in the American League anymore.
My guest is Bill Lee, who's a pitcher formerly with the Boston Red Sox and the Montreal Expos. He lives in Canada. He's written a memoir, and it's titled The Wrong Stuff. You're saying that, you know, you just kind of transcend pain when you're pitching. But on the other hand, I know that all athletes have come to really rely on drugs to anti-inflammatories and painkillers. Mm-hmm. And you had some problems with that yourself.
Oh, yeah. 74, after the season was over, I went on steridazolidine. They stepped me up from butazolidine because I was throwing every fourth day and we were in a pennant drive. And I remember after the last game, I went home and went to bed. And when I woke up, both my arms were paralyzed. And I could not move. And I'm in this waterbed trying to get out. It was like I'm drowning. I'm suffocating. I can't move. My arms wouldn't work. And what happened is I went into shock. And I had to have an injection of Benadryl, I think it was, to stimulate my adrenal glands. Because my adrenal glands were just played out, is what it meant it to. It was a combination of steridazolidine and adrenaline. You know, when you secrete adrenaline in times of crisis, and pitchers do it all the time, everybody does it, but we do it more, it seems like. And I remember that day. I was scared, but I got better, and I realized what I was doing wrong. But, you know, anti-inflammatories give you an edge, and all of these guys are taking anti-inflammatories. I don't know if Carlton does, but I know if he did, it'd add, like, you know, 10 miles to his fastball and stuff, and they put you on them because your performance is enhanced. But you can reach that state, but you have to be a total physical specimen. You got to be like Carlton. You can't do commercials. You got to stay away from people. You have to be a mystic. You have to do everything, you know, by yourself. You have to be completely away from society to be the best. And I wasn't that way. I wasn't the best because I lived with society. I did everything anyone ever asked me to do, and I never said no. And because of that, never saying no, it got me in a lot of trouble. And I used butazolidine and steridazolidine and Indocin and Motrin, you know. I'm working my way back down, and I'm riding my bicycle 35 miles, so I don't need it anymore. Now I'm just down to aspirin. So I've gone full cycle, you know. But eventually my muscles and my whole body will be healthy, and I will be, you know, eating nothing bad.
Do you think that the whole sport needs to wean itself from those drugs to find a way of playing without hooked into that?
Oh, you're right. When the season's over, the first thing I would do, instead of going on the banquet circuit, I would send every ball player to Labrador and let him salmon fish and hike back into the mountains for 3 months until the snow drove him back out to cleanse his body. And then when he got back here, I would force him to split wood and chop wood and, you know, replenish, you know, the natural energy source that we should all run on instead of splitting atoms, split wood. And then when the spring melts and stuff, then he's got to tap trees and get sap and do things like this. In other words, you've got to use your time correctly instead of wasting your time doing banquets and doing this and doing that. And, you know, and I'd like to, you know, in Canada, I've found peace. And I found something that I wouldn't have found in the United States because I couldn't say no. But up there's not too many people asking to do things. So you have some time to yourself.
And in addition to the anti-inflammatories and stuff, I know you'd also drank a lot and did a lot of marijuana and hash and mescaline. Are you still interested in psychedelics and in marijuana and other kind of chemical and herbal highs? Because I know you're trying to get out of the antidepressant drugs.
Yeah, I do a lot of – I used to – well, I don't – I drink coffee like right now. I was meditating in the lobby, and I said – all of a sudden 30 minutes went by, and boom, I thought I was there for a minute. It was great. So I'm getting better, and I still drink coffee, but it makes me perspire. It makes me talk real fast like I am right now, and I don't like that. And, yeah, I'm getting better. But everybody's got to go through that phase because you've got to elevate your consciousness, and you can't do it. So you do it, you know, one way, which is illegal, but it gives you a glimpse of something that you can reach without it. And it's an amazing thing. And they put it down because they want you to drink coffee. They want you to, you know, to anytime you're down, drink a Coca-Cola, get that sugar high, get that buzz, get that caffeine going, boom. And then they want you to pound the Budweiser, you know, and then they want you to really get up there and then, boom, collapse and come down, you know, and wake up and then pound the coffee again and go through the whole cycle again. That's the nature of our whole society.
You pointed out that Bowie Kuhn preaches about how bad alcohol is and what a negative effect it's having on sports, but then on the other hand, he's perfectly delighted to have beer sponsoring baseball games on TV.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. It's the nature of things. It's, you know, I still drink beer, and I'll always drink it because I consider it liquid bread, but not to the excess, you know, and I believe that all my buddies that do drink and like to, they all belong to the Warren Street Running Club, you know, in Jersey City, the best running club in the world. They all run between bars, but they're doing 12 miles a day, you know, so they have justified the fact that they can have a beer. And if people work hard, then they can, you know. But I don't believe they should criticize me because, you know, and they never really, I never really said I smoked. I said I used it, and they asked me how, you know. And I said I sprinkled it on my buckwheat pancakes, you know, and it made me impervious to the bus fumes when I ran 5 miles to the ballpark. And they go, oh, I guess Bowie will buy that. And I was amazed at how ignorant they really were to the entire world out here and the things that are happening. And I just, it was amazing because I was on Jack Daniels really heavy, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, I get into a little herb, and then boom, I quit drinking totally. And it was great. I was cleaning my system out. And I was running and doing stretches a lot more, and my flexibility increased, and my liver got better, you know, and I quit getting red in the face, and it was nice.
I guess it's Bill Lee, if you're just joining us. You write that when you were in college, that all the college coaches would preach to the students that sex would sap your strength, and you know you shouldn't have sex if you have a game coming up. Is that kind of stuff still preached either in pro ball or in college, to your knowledge?
Well, I think it's looked upon, you know, as a negative thing. But I guess the best thing that ever happened was the guy David Waddle. I guess he was an 880 man in the Olympics, and he came to the story that he got laid about 20 minutes before he ran the world record time when he won the gold medal, and he did more for sex before an athletic event than anyone in the history of the game. And I think it's something that it's overplayed. Relaxation, you can gain it without it. I mean, I guess Gandhi gave it up at 39, you know, and there's his wife, his disgruntled wife. She faded right out of the movie after that, you know. She was tagging along behind, but she didn't really want to be there. And I think it's all because men and women are different, and it's women reach their peak when they're like 30, and men are they're into baseball when they're 30.
And it's well, it sounds like the men who are into baseball though were very much into sex. I mean, you describe players right near the bullpen having sex while the game is going on with groupies from the stands
before the game.
Oh, okay, before the game,
right? You know,
close enough.
Right. Once the national anthem's played, I mean, let's not get carried away now, Tiger. No, it's a normal thing. I heard of guys in box seats up above in the Houston Astrodome, you know. Yeah, there's nooks and crannies all over the place, and there's baseball annies all over the world. And there's Chicago Shirley, and there's Detroit Shirley, and there's probably Philadelphia Shirley out there. Who knows? You know, and it's the nature. People want to be, it's called associationism, and it's wrong. You shouldn't associate with ball players just because they're ball players or because they're big hunks or this and that. But that's the way our world operates. And the greatest relationships you'll ever have are when you start liking somebody for their head and don't like them for other reasons that your eyes behold as something of beauty.
What do you think it does to players' personalities when they're when they have, you know, dozens of groupies around them all the time wanting to go to bed with them?
Well, I remember Bobby Orr. He used to stand in the center ring, and there would be women around him like time on the clock, and he would spin around, and where he stopped, that was a lucky person, you know? And that's, I wouldn't want to live my life being time on the clock, you know? And I felt sorry for the women, and I feel sorry for the athlete, too, you know? The best relationships are the ones that you don't have, you know, and it's strange. It's maybe I wouldn't be saying the same thing if I was 23 years old. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, you learn a lot over the course of your life. And there's a time and a place for everything. But remember, I guess each woman only can ovulate one egg every 28 days, so she's a lunatic. And the man runs on a solar cycle.
This is a pun on lunar, right?
It's not a pun on lunar. It's a truth. But I believe in it. I'm a lunatic, too. I mean, people call me that. But it's because I honor that cyclic thing, you know. And I'll always believe in it. You know, it's bringing down the moon, you know. People think I'm a witch in some ways because I predict things and stuff like that. It's not that. It's just that I'm more in harmony with the earth, and I'm not fighting gravity. I live with gravity.
My guest is Bill Lee, pitcher formerly with the Boston Red Sox, with the Montreal Expos, has written a memoir called The Wrong Stuff. Must be hard to keep a marriage together when the man's on the road most of the time and is totally surrounded by women inviting him to bed.
You're right. You're right. It's tough. And I tried to keep everything open for the longest time. And, you know, I loved my wife. And when she left me, it was the worst. It crushed me for so bad for 2 years. I was just a wreck, you know. And then finally I found a girl up in Montreal. Saw her throw a football, you know. And it was a combination of woman, child. And it was, you know, I couldn't have my kids. Now I had a wife and my kids, you know, all together. And it's just kind of a substitute. You know, and she's just as bad as the first one, though, and not wanting you to go out anywhere on your own, you know, handcuffing you around and stuff. And it's difficult. I don't know where the answer is in all this, you know, because it makes women, the wives are paranoid and everything else, especially the athlete's wife. I mean, I've never seen such an insecure lot in my entire life. You know, and all they do is talk about the soaps and this and that. And it's not Kathy, it's Mrs. So-and-so. Or it's not, you know, they don't have their own personality. And it's a sad, sad state of affairs.
How much of that do you think is tied up with the way the men who are the athletes treat their wives?
Well, I don't know. We're all victims of this society on this bad foundation. And, you know, there's... You're right. They're all wrong. It's a wrong. They treat them wrong, and the wives treat them back wrong, and it's a double negative, and they think they're getting a positive result.
When you were traded to the Expos from the Red Sox, you got a form letter?
They sent one out. They do that all the time. That's standard. But they did call me, and they called me from Florida saying it was on December 7th, 1982, or 1979, or was it 8? Yeah, it was 8. When I got, because I played for Montreal in 79. So it was on December 7th. They called me and said that I'd gotten traded. You know, I knew I was going to get traded because I knew they weren't going to let me be a 10-year man. And it hurt still because the fans really liked me. And I got standing ovations. Even the last game, I didn't even play. I just walked off the field. I got a standing ovation because the fans knew where I was coming from. And management couldn't handle that. But... you know, I love the Red Sox. I went back again, and they were looking for a left-handed pitcher that could get left-handed hitters out. And I walk into the clubhouse, and they go, you know, they're scared. But all the old ball players ran up to me, and they enjoyed seeing me again and seeing that I was alive. And You know, I was just coming in trying to get baseball bats to take back to New Brunswick with me.
What do those form letters look like?
They're just pink slips. They're, you know, transactions. They say so-and-so, da-da-da, it's been, you know, gone through waivers and such, and he's gone to this club, you know, and it's just their way of dealing, trading, you know, like I am a cow in this herd, and now I'm going to this herd. And when that cow is finished, then he's released. He gets his pink slip. He's cut off.
Do most people get called in advance?
It's standard operating. Usually they find out in the press. You know, it leaks to the press before they even told firsthand. That happened to Al Oliver. They were out at a party that night. John McHale had kissed Al Oliver's wife at 11 o'clock and saying how great it was to be on the club, and he had actually already traded him to San Francisco at 10. So there, it's like the natural. It's like the GMs. There's something evil in this world, you know.
So you think there's a lot of distrust now between the players and management?
Oh, there's always has been.
Yeah.
But you look up to them. They're above you, you know. They're supposedly, but they're not. They're actually beneath you, but you're looking up to them like they're above you. It's an optical illusion.
How did you like playing for the Expos?
I loved it. I love the fans. I love the French, you know, the atmosphere. I love their romanticism and the fact that they love life and they drink and they're happy and they're, you know, they're romantic and they're, I love Montreal. What a beautiful little city, you know. And they loved me, and it was a mutual relationship. And
why were you let go from the team?
Well, just because Jim Fanning had had a team meeting and challenged anybody to a fight, and I accepted that challenge. And then when I, you know, he didn't show up, you know, for the fight, I went back and challenged him again and tore my uniform up and, you know, said, let's go. He says, not to you, you know, it was weird. I stuck up for Rodney, and Rodney had been mistreated, and the events, it was a trap, it was a ploy. I don't know why they released me, because they cut off their nose despite their face. They needed me bad that year. They needed a left-hander to get people out, because Woody Freiman, who they put all their money on and paid him $800,000 to pitch, he broke his elbow and couldn't even pitch an inning that year. And here they were paying me, and I was getting a lot less than that. I was getting like $225,000. They were paying me not to play. And they, oh, I can't believe they did it. And they had a chance for first place. But instead of, no way, you know, they were going to get a left-hander from somewhere else to do the job. And Boston was going to do the same. And it took them a long time.
Did you try to get into another major league team after that?
I waited around and thought that someone would call me, and no one did. And after that, then I just decided to play in Quebec, where my family was, instead of moving people. And at the end of the year, I went and played to the West Coast and played basketball all winter, and then worked out with the college teams and got in shape for spring training. And I sent out letters, and no one called me. So finally, I was working with the Atlanta scouts on the West Coast, and they said, you're throwing too good, Bill. You should be pitching again. And they called Atlanta, and Henry Aaron, the assistant general manager, player development, heard I was throwing good. And he said, you know, he called me at my grandmother's house and said, Bill, we heard great things. You're throwing the ball well. We need help desperately. He says, how soon can you get here? I said, I got to go to San Francisco, and I can fly out. I'll be there in a day. He says, okay, you go to San Francisco, and I'll talk to Mr. Mullins, and I'll call you back. That was the key word, Mr. Mullins. He's above him. And they never called me back. And it was amazing because my dad just got madder and madder by the day. And he finally called him. I would not call the Atlanta organization and ask for Henry. I had talked to him two separate times on the phone, and he sounded so nice. Then when my dad called, I had been already left town and went back to Yuma, Arizona, trying to try out with San Diego, but I couldn't even try out with him. And it was amazing because he says, we don't owe Bill Lee. Henry Aaron said to my dad, we don't owe Bill Lee anything. And my dad says, yes, you owe him one thing. You owe him a call back and tell him that you're not going to be needing his services. And I couldn't believe it because I thought Henry Aaron was God, you know. I realize we all, you know, when someone above you slaps your hand, those guys jump.
You've been playing anyways, though. You've been playing semi-pro ball, and you've been playing in South America.
Yeah, I play in South America during the winter. And I was so thankful to Mr. Padron, Senor Padron down there with the Tiburones, because he gave me a chance, and I did good for him, you know. And, you know, I did poorly when I started out, but the fans stuck with me, and I got better and better, and then they really liked me. And I was, you know, I taught the young kids to play basketball down on the ocean. We'd have pickup basketball games, and they would tackle and stuff, and finally I taught them not to use their hands and stuff, and I thought it was the greatest experience, teaching kids that never played basketball to play basketball.
How long do you think you'll be able to play for? I know it's a question every athlete has to ask themselves.
Well, based on what I know now, I think, as you know, you never know if you're going to get seriously injured. But if I get injured, I know how to lay down like a cat and how to mend. In 6 weeks, I'll be healthy again. And then all I have to do is exercise that area, and it will rehabilitate itself. So I can compete till I'm 45 easy, you know, as long as I know the things I know now. And compete at a fine level. You'll find that Carlton will be able to. He'll get better with age, actually, I think. I think even though if he's 40, it doesn't matter. He'll be able to pitch till he's 50. He'll be the greatest thing that ever. I mean, he's a saint, you know. He's above it. I don't know him as, you know, he's a yogi. You know, I consider him up there. And, you know, I'm proud that he doesn't do anything. He doesn't speak to the press, because when he made that judgment a long time ago, he actually became a priest kind of thing in my mind. You know, I don't do that because I think I have to be the one to yell and to change things and to push, you know, tell them that things are not right, you know. Something's rotten in the state of Denmark, and I'll do that.
Well, I regret we're out of time. I really want to thank you a lot. It's been very interesting. Thanks a lot for being here.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Bill Lee. He's a pitcher. He was with the Boston Red Sox from 69 to 79, then with the Montreal Expos till 82. He's living in Canada now, playing ball in Canada and in South America. He's written a new memoir. It's called The Wrong Stuff, and it's just been published by the Viking Press, the title again, The Wrong Stuff. And Billy's also doing book reviews and commentary for CBC in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Thanks again for talking with us.